Well, this is Labor Day weekend. And theoretically, our culture is asking the question, what is the meaning of our work? But we all know better. I say theoretically, that's the question we're asking, but we're really not asking the question at all. We're more excited about the fact that we have another day off. And we're not asking why in the world we work. But I'm going to ask that question this morning because I think that is an important question. Why do you do what you do? Why do you spend so many hours laboring? What's the point of it all? I remember well when I enlisted in the Navy many, many years ago, and I was stationed as a seaman then, on an aircraft carrier. And while the planes were up flying around somewhere, they lined us up across the stern of the flight deck, and they gave us all scrub brushes, and they put lye on the deck, and we scrubbed the 980-some feet from the stern to the bow. When we got to the bow, the planes hadn't returned, so they turned us around, and we scrubbed the 980-some feet from the bow to the stern. Because they didn't want to see us idle. They wanted to just keep us busy. Sad to say, a lot of people work that way. They just have to have something to do in order to make enough money to pay the bills for that week. That's sad. If that's your view of your work, that's sad. We need to have an understanding of what God thinks of work. And so we're going to look at that this morning. Because God, in this psalm, is talking about what meaningful work really is. That's the climax of the psalm. Psalm 90 is kind of familiar to many of us, I'm sure. It climaxes in those last two verses, 16 and 17. May your deeds be shown to your servants, your splendor to their children. May the favor of the Lord our God rest upon us, establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. Now, we really can't understand the climax unless we work our way through the psalm. And that's what we're going to be doing this morning, to get a picture of what God is speaking to us about in terms of our work. You'll know from the psalm and your familiarity with the psalm that the basic thrust of Psalm 90 is where Moses, who wrote the psalm, Moses is comparing the eternity, the everlastingness of God with a striking contrast of the split moment of your existence and mine. That's the thrust of Psalm 90. He begins referring to the fact that God is eternal. God is from everlasting to everlasting. Moses is writing out of the experience of having been in the wilderness for those years under God's anger, by the way. And so he writes about that here, and he's conscious of the weakness of Israel in the wilderness. He's conscious of the fact that they have very little in the way of resources. They have been set free, miraculously, by the sovereignty of God, bringing them out of slavery in Egypt. They've been planted in the wilderness, where they're learning who they are. And so Moses begins with those wonderful opening words, Lord, you have been our dwelling place. You have been our dwelling place throughout all generations. In other words, here they were in the wilderness. They were struggling with how much food they had or how little food they had and how little water they had. And they had to constantly be reminded that they could not do it on their own. They needed God's presence with them. And they were often, as you know, very frustrated and annoyed with that. And so Moses is now reminding him of the principle of life, that the Lord is our dwelling place throughout all generations. He was the dwelling place for pilgrim Abraham. He was the dwelling place for pilgrim Isaac. He was the dwelling place for pilgrim Jacob. And now, having set his people free from bondage in Egypt, he is again their dwelling place, their home. Here's where they were reminded that God is always the home for homeless, that God is the father for the fatherless, that God is the one who provides for the needy. And so that's the basic thrust of the first verse. He reminds them again, before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the earth and the world from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Amazing text, that verse. From everlasting to everlasting, you are God. God alone is the one who has absolutely no need. God didn't even need a creation. God didn't need you or me. Arthur Pink, some of you are familiar with Arthur Pink, the Puritan who wrote, God is solitary in his majesty, unique in his excellency, peerless or unequaled in his perfections. He sustains all, but is himself independent of all. He gives to all, and yet is enriched by none. God is a marvelous being. We are totally dependent upon him. He is indeed our dwelling place. But when you come to the next cluster of verses, 3-6, you discover a problem. Because we have a problem. Our existence is a split moment, if you will. The eternal God made us, and he made us out of dust. And to dust we are going to return. Here today, gone tomorrow. By our standards, 1,000 years seems rather staggering. What were you doing 1,000 years ago? Well, you know, if you think about our world, 1,000 years ago, the Vikings established a colony in Greenland in 982. The Hugh Capet was elected King of France in 987. The musical notations that you used and I used a moment ago to sing came into being in 990. Leif Erikson discovered the east coast of America in 1000. Seems like yesterday, doesn't it? 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that's just gone by, or like a watch in the night, Moses writes. We flip by, but 1,000 years in God's sight is like that. One generation after another is swallowed up in death before the everlasting God. And Moses describes it in verses 5 and 6 by saying that in contrast with God, the eternal God, human life is like the sleep of death, or it's like that withering grass that comes up new in the morning, and by evening it's gone. Verses 7 through 11, Moses gives us another ingredient in all this, where we need to understand our evaporating lives. Verses 7 to 11 tell us that this fleeting quality of your life and mine is not by accident. God didn't create us to die. He created us to live in fellowship with him. But something happened. Moses writes, we are consumed by your anger and terrified by your indignation. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. All our days pass away under your wrath. Moses saw a whole generation pass away there in the wilderness, like withering grass because they had disobeyed. And that's true for all human life. Whether we live 70 years or 80, he reminds us, they quickly pass and we fly away. He tells us that we're living under the curse, under the death sentence in this fallen world. And the span of our years, he describes with very interesting words as trouble and sorrow. He's almost borrowing words out of Genesis 3, where God comes with a curse on rebellious humanity. And God tells us that we're going to have painful toil and that we will work by the sweat of our brow, labor, trouble, sorrow, as Moses describes it. And then Moses concludes his thoughts about God's eternity and the brevity of human life in the 11th verse. And he asks this rather astonishing question: who knows the power of your anger? That's a question. Who knows the power of your anger? Maybe I could put it just a little differently. Who can measure how angry God is? And the answer to that, he says, is your wrath is as great as the fear that's due you. Kind of a puzzling answer. Your wrath is as great as the fear that's due you. The way I've tried to understand that is something like this, that the way we can understand how angry God is at our sin is only in the measure that we love him and respect him and fear him. And the more we love him and the more we fear him, the better we will understand his anger. So when Moses asks the question, who knows the power of your anger? You and I, sitting here, this side of the cross, can say, I know who knows the power of your anger, don't we? Who is the one who loved the Lord his God with all of his heart and all of his soul? A love that drove him, mind you, to the cross. He's the one and the only one who really understands the anger of his Father against sin. He's the one whom Isaiah says the Lord laid on him the iniquity of us all. And of course, he's the one who cried out, not Abba this time, but my God, why have you forsaken me? He could measure the power of God's anger against our sin. We'll remember that here pretty soon when we come to this table. And when we do, please think, who alone knows the power of God's anger against my sin? That 8th verse in the psalm is so interesting because it points out our secret sins in the light of his presence. That's how we kind of waste our lives, it seems to me, by ducking away from sin, which is open and brilliant to God, and yet we kind of smother it by our escape mechanisms. But Jesus did not duck it. Jesus measured it. Well, the wrestling of those 11 verses that we've talked about so far issue into a prayer. Prayer of Moses. And a quick glance at verses 12 to 14 tell us that it's a prayer to better understand our problem. Teach us to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom, he prays. What's wisdom? What's wisdom in the Bible? Well, wisdom in the Bible is that God-given ability to look at life, its circumstances, who we are, what our nature is, to look at it all through the perspective of God's will. As you know, the fool in the Bible is the other way around. He's the one that denies God's existence. The wise person is the one who has God at the center of everything. And so that's our prayer. Teach us to number our days aright, that we may get a heart of wisdom. Teach us in such a way that this little bubble that we call our life and about which we think is so important, that that bubble may burst and we understand life in the light of God's will. And so he comes to verses 13 and 14, and he begs God then in the light of that not to leave us, not to let us perish as we rightly deserve, but to relent, to turn around and come back to us once again, because only then, if God comes back in love and grace, will we be able to, as he says, sing for joy and be glad all my days. And isn't that why we come to this communion table in a minute? Because thanks to God's grace, we have seen that bubble burst of what we thought life was all about. We see it now in God's light. And we have now been given grace through him to sing for joy and be glad all our days. Because there at the cross is where verse 15 is answered. Make us glad for as many days as you have afflicted us, for as many years as we have seen trouble. In other words, make us prodigal sons and prodigal daughters. Once again, your children, so that all of the balance between God's anger and God's love takes place in our hearts. Well, that leads us to the climax. You didn't think we were going to get there, did you? The climax is verse 16 and 17, as I've indicated. And in the light of all of that, Moses comes to speak about God's work in verse 16 and our work. That's what we're looking for in verse 17. Verse 16, may your deeds be shown to your servants, your splendor to their children. God's deeds, God's work. What is God's work? What are God's deeds? Well, he's talked about that in the psalm, hasn't he? In verse 2, he talked about how God brought into existence the earth and the world, he tells us. God's creation. That's one work. If you move down the psalm a little further to verses 13 to 15, you talk about another work of God, which is God's recreation, where he has compassion on his servants after God relents, so to speak, and comes back again, changes mind towards us, where he satisfies us with his love and he enables us to sing for joy and be glad. That's God's recreative work. And Moses has that in mind when he says, may your deeds be shown to your children and your splendor to their children. God's work gives purpose and meaning to our work. I'll say that again. It's in the degree that we understand God's work that we can understand something of the purpose for our work. And so he finally comes to verse 17. May the favor of the Lord our God rest upon us. Establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. The key verb is the verb establish. It must be important. He repeats it twice. Establish the work of our hands. And what is to establish something? When you establish something, what are you doing? You make it firm. You make it solid. You make it unshakable. You fix something permanently. Moses' prayer is that God will enable us to establish whatever we do with our hands, so to speak, so that it has permanence, lasting value. That's not caught up in this split moment thing that he was talking about the brevity of human life, but that it lasts. Let me put it this way. Without the cross of Christ, without the finished work of Jesus dying for us, bearing our burdens away, let me say, and presenting a total righteousness to the Father, without him doing that on our behalf, all of your work and mine will end up in the same place, in the grave. There's no lasting quality to anything that we do other than through Christ and his finished work. That's exactly the message of Ecclesiastes and the rest of the Bible. Ecclesiastes, as you know, is known because it keeps saying, meaningless, meaningless, or vanity of vanities. It's all for nothing, this work that we have, unless God is at the center. Establish the work of our hands. And isn't that what we're praying about when we prayed the Lord's Prayer just a little while ago? Your kingdom come, we said. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. What is that other than a prayer that your work and mine is an extension, an outflowing of God's great work? Well, as I said in the beginning, this is Labor Day weekend. A lot of folks are much more concerned about vacation than they are vocation. But Psalm 90 is concerned about vocation, our calling, our divine calling in life. And when Moses talks about the work of our hands, he's talking about what God has called us to do in this life. And that involves, of course, many things. It certainly includes all of our spiritual endeavors, the way we worship, the way we read our Bibles, the way we witness, the way we pray, the way we sing. Sure. But the work of our hands is much more than that, isn't it? The work of our hands includes the way you plant the potatoes, or the way you do the dishes, or the way you repair the car, the way you work the computer. The work of our hands is doing everything for the glory of God and his majesty. I know I'm talking to a bunch of Presbyterians, but you know the answer to that question. What is the chief end of man? I should ask you to respond that. To glorify God and enjoy him forever. Amen. That's what the psalm is talking about when he says, establish the work of our hands. Whatever I do, let it be to your glory. So in closing then, as we reflect upon our personal life and our personal labor, our Labor Day prayer, to put it very briefly, is this. Let my work also be my worship. Let my work be my worship. establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands.